Hey, I'm Steph, and this is Not Today. Hello, and welcome, or welcome back. Before we jump into our case for the week, I wanted to let you know that the poll for bonus episode number 55 will be coming out soon over on our Patreon. Every month, I give our patrons three choices that they get to vote on, and sometimes that vote is extremely close, and other times, cases will win by a landslide. But every time, we are having some really interesting conversation and talking about some incredible stories. So if you want to hear all of our bonus episodes and vote on the stories you want to hear, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. You could binge for a very long time on 54 episodes with a 55th on the way, so go check it out. But with the shameless self-plug out of the way, why don't we get into our case for the week? Karen Kummerer was kidnapped by her ex-boyfriend, who took her on the run for over a week. This was a terrifying experience, but she hopes that her story can help someone somewhere out there. So let's get into it. This case contains details that may be distressing to some. Listener discretion is advised. In 2006, 42-year-old Karen Kummerer was living in Daytona Beach, Florida. She had an accounting degree and worked as a director of finance at the Burt Fish Medical Center. She owned her own home and had just bought herself a brand new 2006 GT Mustang. So she was rolling up to work in style. That year, Karen had just separated from her husband of 17 years, so she was having herself a fresh start, and she was starting to date again. It had taken her a while to get back into the dating scene, but at this point, she was feeling really independent and very good about where she was in her life. Brenna Randall, Karen's niece, had been very close with Karen all her life. She described Karen as very independent, very fun, and goofy. She spoke her mind when she had something to say. And in 2006, Brenna was 18 years old and living with her Aunt Karen. They were having a great time living together. Brenna said she thinks her living there helped her Aunt Karen after her divorce. They shared a ton of laughs, and she was a shoulder to lean on during those rough days. This was a big transitional time in Karen's life. She had been in a marriage for so long, and now she was single and going on dates for the first time in over 17 years, which I can only imagine would be very intimidating. But she was ready. So one night, at the end of January 2006, Karen and her sister Lisa went out to a restaurant and bar on the water called the Ocean Deck. This was a really fun place with live music and plenty of fun drinks, so it was a great place to meet people. And that night, Karen ended up meeting a man named Joseph Scott Freeman, who went by Scott. Scott had approached Karen and asked her to dance with him, and she was instantly intrigued. She liked what she saw. Scott was a big, muscular guy. He had striking blue eyes and blonde hair, and he told Karen that he was working as a personal trainer, which she was interested in because she had just started working out herself. And the two had a really fun night together. She felt that spark that she had been searching for such a long time. So the next morning, Karen's sister called her to find out how everything went with Scott, and Karen had nothing but good things to say. She was really excited about this guy, and the two started seeing each other more and more. A couple weeks later, on Valentine's Day, Scott got Karen a few gifts. He got her flowers and a set of weights, and spent a bit of money on her, which really surprised Karen. I don't know how I would feel about the guy I just started seeing gifting me weights for Valentine's Day, but Karen seemed to be into it because I guess they bonded over the fact that she was starting to work out, he was a personal trainer. I guess it could be cute in that context if he's like, oh yeah, I'll come over and help you work out and we can, you know, bond over this shared interest. I get it, but also, without context, yikes. But Karen didn't look at it that way. They hadn't known each other for all that long, and he had gone out of his way to make her feel special. So this seemed like the kind of thing a really nice guy would do. Scott would take Karen out dancing at clubs in Daytona, and they would go out to dinner together. So overall, she was really enjoying spending time with him. They were having a ton of fun, sharing a lot of laughs, and it didn't take long before she was head over heels for him. She hadn't felt this kind of excitement in a relationship in a long time. Her marriage hadn't been going well for a while before she and her husband finally divorced, so she was very excited that she was getting those butterflies and feeling a spark with Scott. But things wouldn't stay as perfect as they seemed, and there were some red flags early on. Taryn worked with a woman who was into tarot cards and crystals, and she had a tarot card reader in Connecticut that scheduled readings over the phone. So this friend gave Karen her number and told her that she should try it out. Not for any specific reason, just because it's kind of fun to get your tarot cards read. And Karen was really curious about it, so she gave the woman a call. As she got her reading, the woman pulled the devil card and told Karen that she had recently met this person, but he's crazy and you need to get the heck out of there as soon as possible. Karen did think this was weird. She hadn't told the tarot card reader that she had recently started dating Scott, but she figured this woman didn't know what she was talking about. Little did she know, this woman was very right. And Brenna started noticing that Scott was around all the time. Not only that, but he started leaving a lot of his things at their house. And then one day, he showed up and basically never left. Scott had been living with his parents at the time, and Karen happened to live right down the road from them, so Scott was at her house all the time. And as happy as Scott was making Karen, she wasn't really looking to jump into a very serious, committed relationship so quickly. She was definitely happy going on dates with him, and he made her happy, but she wasn't looking to settle down with someone new right now. She had just gotten out of a 17-year marriage. She wasn't looking for a new one. But one day when she came home from work, she found Scott sitting on her couch, and he told her, "Yeah, I moved in." No conversation was had about him moving in, or the next steps in their relationship. He just decided he wanted to, so he did. Usually, that's a massive step that's talked about and should be a very exciting thing, but Karen was not happy. She didn't want Scott to move in. So Karen told him, "Well, maybe you need to leave." But Scott wasn't accepting that. He told her he had already been getting mail to her house for almost a month and she hadn't even realized. Scott would check her mailbox for his mail before she got home from work, so she didn't really have the opportunity to realize. He was just sneakily moving into her house for the course of a month, and then one day he was just there. And Karen didn't really know what to make of this, because she did really like him, but this was all just a lot. She didn't necessarily want to break up with him, but she also didn't really want him living in her home. But Scott was there all the time anyway, and he had already moved all his stuff in, so she just kind of allowed it to happen. But unsurprisingly, Scott's behavior from there only got worse. Karen's main concern when he first moved in was that she didn't want to jump into this serious relationship too quickly. But not long after him living there, that was the least of her concerns, because Scott had started becoming very possessive over Karen. He wanted to be with her all the time, and didn't want her to do anything with anyone else, even Brenna, who was only 18 or 19 at the time, and lived there, by the way. If Brenna wanted to go shopping with Karen, that was a problem for Scott. He would tell her, "You guys don't need to be doing that." And he also began scrutinizing everything she did, including policing what she wore. If Karen came out into the living room wearing a skirt and a cute top, Scott told her she needed to go change because people were going to think she was trash. Brenna recalled Karen changing almost instantly after Scott moved in. She became a much smaller version of herself and ignored Scott's major red flags. Karen's sister Lisa and her boyfriend came over one evening for dinner, and as Lisa was putting something in the fridge, she noticed some syringes. Lisa's boyfriend, who was standing there with her, asked, "Why are there steroids in the fridge? Do you know that's illegal?" So Lisa confronted Karen about this, asking her why she had steroids in her fridge, and she told Lisa Scott used them for working out. And Lisa was very concerned hearing that. Scott was already a piece of work and a very unpleasant guy to be around, but roid rage was a real thing and would only make him worse. So red flags were definitely raised for Lisa at that point. By March of 2006, Scott and Karen had been dating for a few months, and Scott suggested Brenna move out to find a place of her own. In his eyes, she was old enough to go live with her friends. And things had definitely become tense in the house. Brenna could absolutely tell that Scott did not like her. She believed at that point that she was just an obstacle for him to control Karen. And being asked to move out was very shocking for Brenna. Karen and Scott had only been together for 3 months at that point, and he already had so much control over Karen and her life. And Karen and Brenna had been in such a good place before she met Scott, and now, only a few months later, they were asking Brenna to leave. And she knew this wasn't Karen's idea or wish, it was Scott's. Around the same time Scott suggested Brenna move out was when the domestic violence began. He started holding Karen down and screaming at her all night long. Karen would have her phone in her hands, but he'd rip it away from her and break it so she couldn't call the police. He was a very big person and weighed about 220 pounds. Karen felt like she couldn't get away from him. It became apparent very quickly that something was wrong after Brenna moved out. The only time she could talk to Karen was when she was at work away from Scott. Karen had never been like this, but when she asked her aunt what was going on, Karen told her she couldn't talk about it, which had never been a response that Karen had given Brenna. They talked about everything. Karen had also become very withdrawn. Brenna said had she known how bad it was, she never would have left. And I don't know that Brenna staying there actually would have done anything, because Scott was a very dangerous and clearly violent man. If anything, it probably would have just put Brenna in danger as well. So really, Scott just needed to leave. He needed to get out of there. And everyone could see that except for Karen at this point. Karen stopped seeing family and friends, she made excuses for why she couldn't hang out, and she was always doing something with Scott. According to her sister, Karen had some serious self-confidence issues at the time, and that was a major contributor for why Scott was able to control her so much. She had been through a tough divorce, and had been in a bad spot for a while. She had only just started feeling better when she met Scott. Lisa had actually been a survivor of domestic abuse in the past herself, so she knew the signs. She could recognize what Karen was going through before she even told anyone. Everyone handles those types of situations differently, but the fear paralyzed her. During a fight, Karen would tell Scott he needed to leave, but Scott just wouldn't. He told Karen after he moved in with her that she could evict him, but it would have to go through the courts. She didn't have that kind of control over the situation. It needed to be legally figured out. She honestly didn't know how this could be happening to her. How had this relationship spiraled out of control so quickly? It had only been a few short months. She felt embarrassed that she had gotten herself into a relationship like this, because before then, she had been so independent and, like I said, was doing better. But now, she felt very in over her head. It had gotten to the point where she was fearing for her safety and had had enough. She decided she would do anything she had to get Scott out of her home, even if she had to get an eviction notice, like he said. By July of 2006, Scott had been in Karen's life for 7 months, and things had been spiraling out of control since about month 3, so it had already been pretty bad for a while, and they didn't know each other for all that long. And one night, Karen reached her breaking point. That night, Scott held Karen down and screamed at her all night long. And the next morning, after he let her up, Karen got dressed and went to work. She hadn't been out of the house for more than a few minutes before he began calling her on her cell phone and demanding she come back. And as she walked into the office that day, she had Scott on speakerphone. She said to one of her coworkers, "You need to hear this," and she held up her phone. Scott, at the time, was yelling at Karen, "If you don't come back, I'm gonna kill you." Her friend was horrified. And now Karen had witnesses, so she told Scott he needed to leave. And the friend she had at work took Karen back home to get her dog and a few essentials. When they pulled into the driveway, Scott pulled up behind the car. But Karen's friend was a bigger woman, and she stood up to Scott, telling him he needed to leave. And as this friend was dealing with Scott outside, Karen slipped into the car with her bag and her dog, Rocky. She stayed at her friend's apartment for the weekend until Scott moved himself out of Karen's house. But even after he was moved out, she didn't feel safe. Despite him being kicked out of her house, he still thought he had possession of Karen. He even went as far to threaten to kill Karen's dog if she didn't spend time with him. He would park his car right behind hers so she couldn't get out of her driveway. And things continued getting progressively worse until Scott began full-blown stalking Karen. She didn't feel safe at home anymore, and so in the beginning of October, she asked Brenna to move in with her again for her safety. Brenna had just turned 19 that October, but she did agree to live with Karen again. Lisa didn't love that Brenna moved back in with Karen. She said being a kid, Brenna thought she could protect Karen, but there really wasn't much she could do, and like I said earlier, she thought that Brenna probably was just putting herself in danger. They didn't really know what Scott was capable of because they hadn't known him for all that long. And on November 11th, 2006, Brenna was at the house along with Karen's other two young nieces who were sitting on the couch in the living room. And Scott just walked into the house like he owned the place. He saw the little girl sitting on the couch and he put his finger up to his lips and said, "Shh," as he went further inside. Scott then waltzed into Karen's bedroom and Karen screamed to Brenna, Brenna, he's here. Brenna could hear Karen screaming at Scott from the other room, telling him he needed to get out of her house. She didn't want him here. She told him she was done with this. But unsurprisingly, Scott didn't listen to Karen. So Karen yelled to Brenna to call the police. And as she was dialing 911 on her phone, Scott walked out the front door and drove off. Brenna later said she wished Karen would have called the police herself, but she said she understood that she was very scared and genuinely needed her help. Karen told Brenna, "You don't understand, he's crazy." She believed he would kill her if she did the wrong thing. And the scary part was, that wasn't a crazy assumption to make. Scott left Karen 24 voicemails on her phone that day, asking her where she was and why she wasn't answering her phone. And while all of this was going on, Karen still had to continue being a normal person and go to work, as if her life wasn't falling apart. Every morning, she would wake up around 5:30 or 6 a.m. and be out the door by the latest 7. And on Monday, November 13th, as Karen got into her car and began driving to work, she pulled up to a stop sign and looked one way before her passenger side door was yanked open. Scott had been waiting for Karen in a bush, right by this stop sign. He knew that she always drove the same way to work. The door had been locked, but Scott had taken a spare key fob and used that to unlock the door and jump into the car with a knife in hand. He told Karen to drive while holding her at knife point and screaming at her. This was the first time he had ever held a weapon to Karen. He told her, "I'm going to cut you right here. You can't hide. I have your social security number. I need to see you." And I cannot imagine being in that car and what Karen must have been thinking. He's threatening her with a weapon. She fully believes her life is in danger. And he's screaming things like, "I have your social security number. I need to see you." Threatening her from every direction. And following that up with, "I need to see you," as if she would have wanted to see him at this point. But it didn't matter to him. He just wanted control. Karen knew in this situation, if she stayed calm and submissive, usually it would make the situation better. So she finally calmed him down enough by assuring him that she would still see him. She promised she would see him tonight. So he allowed her to drop him off where he had parked his Jeep just down the street. And when Scott got out of the car, Karen drove off and immediately called her friend who met her at the Daytona Beach Police Department. They filed for an emergency restraining order, in which Karen stated Scott had tried to choke her, bang her head against the car window, and threw her to the ground. The police told Karen once this was reviewed, they would serve this emergency restraining order tonight. If all went to plan, this restraining order would have been in place for a year, at which point she could hopefully get another. But in the meantime, Lisa brought Karen home since she didn't want her car in the driveway, and she and Brenna sat in the dark all night long. She knew when he was served with a temporary restraining order, he would be very mad. And Brenna and Karen were terrified, thinking Scott would come in and kill them both if he knew they were there. So they sat quietly in the dark all night long. Karen was terrified. She didn't know how Scott could have gotten her key fob to her car. But by this point, it was clear that he was capable of doing some really terrible, scary things. Up until that point, she knew it had been bad, but this was worse than she realized it could get. The next day, Karen changed her phone number and she rekeyed her car. And at that time, she didn't have them change the trunk key because she and the person that she was working with at the dealership agreed that that seemed a bit unnecessary. What was he going to do? Hide in her trunk? But this person at the dealership didn't really know who Karen was dealing with, and I guess Karen just agreed that she didn't have to rekey the trunk, probably just as some wishful thinking. Like, yeah, he's crazy, but he's not that crazy, right? Monday, November 27th, 2006, was 2 weeks after filing the protective order. And that morning, Karen left her house to go to work. After getting only about 150 feet down her road, the trunk ajar light came on in her car. Karen had been shopping the day before, so she figured she had just left it open unintentionally, as she had done before. So she pulled over, got out of the car, and went to shut the trunk. But before she could do that, the trunk flew open, and Scott jumped out, dressed in all black, wearing a mask, and holding a knife. Karen tried to run and began screaming, but he grabbed her by the wrist and pulled her in close and put the knife to her throat and told her, "If you do that again, I'm gonna cut you right here." and that was when she knew for sure that it was Scott. He threw Karen into the passenger seat and closed the door before he got into the driver's seat and took off in Karen's car. He sped over to where his Jeep had been parked and quickly pulled her out. As he walked over to his Jeep, he told her, "If you're going to behave yourself, you can sit up front." And then he threw her inside. And without another word, he took off once again. As he drove, he screamed at Karen, "You're making me do this because you got a restraining order. This is your fault." He had gloves on the center console, and when Karen asked him what those were for, he told her, "So I don't get blood on my hands." Karen asked him what he was going to do with her, and he told her, "I'm just driving." Eventually, he told Karen she better call in sick for work, so she did as she was told. And as she called, she was in a state of shock. At the same time, Brenna needed to call Karen for something, and the first time she called, Karen didn't answer. Not thinking anything of it, Brenna called again, but the second time Karen didn't answer, she started getting nervous, because they had an understanding that if the other called, they would pick up, or try to get back to the other as soon as possible, especially with everything that had been going on. So when Brenna called for a third time, Karen told Scott she was going to have to answer it, otherwise Brenna would know something was up. So Scott told Karen to tell Brenna that he was going to commit suicide, and she was trying to get him to stop. When Karen answered the phone, she told Brenna, "I'm with Scott, and he's threatening to kill himself," and then told Brenna, "Don't call the police." Brenna knew that Karen must be sitting right next to Scott because she could hear the fear in Karen's voice. So she told Karen, "If you want me to call the police, say, 'Don't call the police' again." And Karen said, "Brenna, don't call the police." That was when Brenna hung up the phone and dialed 911 and told them she believed her Aunt Karen had been abducted. Kidnapping cases usually don't end well. Statistically, most victims don't survive after a certain amount of time, so there's almost nothing of a higher priority than a kidnapping case, which meant all hands were on deck to locate the victim before it turned into a homicide. Janet Hawkins, who was a detective for Daytona PD at the time, said they put out a BOLO for Scott immediately. It gave his description, the description of his vehicle, and of Karen, and it let officers know that there was a warrant for his arrest. So if they came into contact with him, to hold him there, and that Karen was a victim. They didn't know which direction they were headed, so they had to start by trying to find a trail. They flagged Karen and Scott's credit cards and bank cards, which meant if any of those cards were used, they would know when and where. And one thing to keep in mind for this case is that the technology they had in 2006 is not what it is today. There are cameras everywhere all the time today, so finding a missing person, while still difficult, is way easier now than it was then. So at that point, all they could really do was wait. Brenna was terrified. She knew firsthand how dangerous Scott was, and she had no idea if Karen was still even alive. Karen said she believed Scott didn't even have a plan when he took her. He thought he could just take her anywhere and no one would do anything. Scott and Karen were headed north from Daytona Beach, and that first night they stayed at a motel called the Sunrise Inn in St. Augustine. Scott made Karen wait in the car as he got the room. He took the car keys with him, he had her cell phone, and he kept an eye on the car the whole time he was checking in. He also called his mother and told her that he and Karen were on vacation together. When they got into the room, Scott gave Karen sleeping pills and forced her to have sex with him. Once again, she knew that complacency and submission was the way that she was going to survive this. Scott had a knife, and she knew he wasn't afraid to use it, so the idea of screaming or trying to get away at this point was out of the picture. Even if she got someone's attention, if they didn't act quickly enough, she would be dead. The next morning, Scott told Karen he had run out of money, so they needed to stop at a bank and Karen could take some money out of her checking account. They drove to a Wachovia bank, where Scott had her withdraw $500 by check. And the whole time, he was right there beside her with the knife in his pocket. Even though she was in public and could have screamed, she didn't feel like she could. Even if she told the bank teller that he was kidnapping her or screamed at the security guard, she believed Scott would have just slit her throat right there. She felt like no one would have been able to move fast enough to save her life, so she didn't say anything. But because Karen withdrew $500, the Daytona police received a notification. Once they got a hit on her bank account, they at least knew that Scott and Karen were in St. Augustine and likely heading northbound. Law enforcement responded to the bank as quickly as possible, but Scott and Karen were already gone. However, they did learn that Scott and Karen were still together, and after receiving the tape, they saw Karen looked terrified, but she was still alive. Scott had a violent history, and they knew he had a history with drugs, so the fact that now he has money was very concerning. They started going through any history they could find on him to hopefully find someone who could tell them anything about him. One of the officers on the Daytona police force definitely knew of Scott. His sister had dated him years ago, and he knew that this guy was trouble. In June of 1991, Kim Copsidas Martin met Scott for the first time. Kim's friend worked at a bowling alley that had a bar, and everyone would hang out there, and that was where she met Scott for the first time. Her first impression of him was that he was handsome. He said he was a firefighter, and she thought he had good potential, because Scott was love-bombing her, which at the time felt very good. She was only 22 years old, and he was 6 years older than her, and Scott came on really strong and was crazy about her. She didn't know just how crazy about her he would actually be. Scott was very charming in the beginning, and they began dating very quickly. When she first met Scott, he was a firefighter, but that did not last long. Soon after they began dating, Scott told Kim that he had been fired from the fire department. And it soon became apparent to Kim that Scott's mother paid for everything in his life, since it was rare that Scott actually held down a job. He also still lived at home and didn't really have to worry about much. And like his relationship with Karen, Scott became very controlling over Kim. He dictated what she did, what she wore, who she talked to, and he was very manipulative. Early on in their relationship, Kim's father had passed away, and so she went to a medium hoping to hear something from her father. And this medium also had tarot cards, and the first card she turned over was the Devil card. She told Kim, "I see a very disturbed person around you. This person is on drugs," and she saw jail, which was alarming, but she didn't entirely believe this tarot card reader. Although Scott would have bouts where he would disappear for days on end with no explanation. It is so crazy to me that both of these women saw a tarot card reader at the time that they started dating Scott, and both times the tarot card reader pulled the Devil card and said, "Hey, you gotta get away from this guy. He's bad news, he's dangerous, and I see jail." And both times they were like, "Well, what do they know? It's only tarot cards." And I could see how you could write that off, because for people who aren't into tarot cards or whatever, like, it does kind of just seem like, what do they know? And honestly, I don't know if I would have felt any differently than Kim or Karen if I had my tarot cards read and a person pulled the Devil card for me, because you take the whole thing with a grain of salt. You don't actually know if this is real or not. And if you're dating this guy and he seems really great, most people wouldn't immediately think, okay, now I must break up with him because this tarot card reader who I've just met for the first time told me I need to. But it is very interesting that both of them had the same experience. At this point in their relationship, Kim did know that Scott was addicted to crack cocaine, which would contribute to his binges and disappearances for days on end. Which is definitely a red flag. Even if you're with someone who's possessive and you don't immediately register that as a major red flag, the crack cocaine, you can't really ignore that one. That one is pretty in your face. This was about 2 years into their relationship, and a friend of Scott and his girlfriend had come down from North Carolina to visit, and the four of them went out for the night. They went out to the club and went drinking and overall had a good time. But when they got home that evening, as they were all chatting about ordering pizza and their fun night that they had just had, Scott suddenly began freaking out, and he pinned Kim against the wall with his hands around her neck. She was terrified. She had no idea what had gotten into him. The police were called, and they showed up, which was when Kim decided that she didn't want to press charges. She was still very young, and had convinced herself that Scott didn't mean it. He had just drank too much that night, and she made excuse after excuse for him. Her head was telling her to get out of this relationship because she knew it was bad, but her 20-something-year-old heart was saying, "But I love him." On January 19th of 2000, Kim came home from work to find Scott in her home already drunk, and he wanted her to go out with him to a bar. She told Scott no. He was already drunk and she didn't want to go out. Which was when his behavior became erratic and he was instantly filled with rage. Kim became suspicious about what was going on because this was aggressive even for Scott. So she went into the bedroom and into the closet and started looking through duffel bags and piles of things until she picked up a box that you would keep checks in. And when she picked it up, it had rattled. When she opened this box, she saw that it was filled with syringes. And that was when she figured out that Scott was shooting up steroids. And that was leading to his crazy erratic behavior. Also, he did crack sometimes. So that had to have been a contributor as well, but the steroids were not helping at all. So Kim approached Scott about what she found in the closet, and that was when he got really angry. He smacked her across the face and attempted to take a bunch of her things and put his hands around her neck and held her against the wall and tried to choke her. Someone must have called the police for Kim because when they showed up that day, they asked her if everything was okay. Kim had been a few steps down the hallway with the police when Scott exited and started walking toward them, screaming at the police. He didn't care the police were there for him. He began cursing at them and telling them to get the F out of there. When they told him they would spray him with pepper spray if he didn't calm down, he told them, "Do it and I'll kill you." He was belligerent and resisted arrest. And it did take pepper spray to finally get him handcuffed. He was a big guy. It took multiple police officers to get him down. And that was Kim's breaking point. She knew she couldn't stay in a situation like that. So in 2006, when Kim's brother caught wind of Scott, he immediately called her and told her, "You're not going to believe this, but Scott kidnapped a woman." And Kim's first thought was, "Holy shit, that could have been me." All they knew at the time was that he was on the run with her and heading north. So her brother asked Kim if she knew where they might be headed. And Kim did have an idea. Her brother then asked if she would be willing to meet with Detective Janet Hawkins, who was working on the case, and Kim agreed. She shared with Detective Hawkins places she had been with Scott and thought maybe he would bring Karen. She knew he had a very good friend who lived in North Carolina, and she thought there was a good chance that he would be taking her there. This story was quickly all over the news, and Kim was terrified for Karen because she knew what Scott was capable of. At that time, Karen and Scott had left St. Augustine and were driving north to North Carolina. They stayed at the Days Inn in Charlotte, and it was the same situation as it had been in St. Augustine. He gave Karen pills and kept the knife on her at all times. When Karen got up the next morning on November 29th and was getting ready to leave, she looked down and saw a notepad on the bedside table in the room. While Scott wasn't looking, she grabbed it and the pen next to it and stuffed them into her pocket. At the time, she didn't even know why she did it, but she did. And from Charlotte, they went to Bryson City, where they stopped to eat at a restaurant called the Barbecue Wagon. A woman named Dana Preston had been the head cook at this restaurant for 11 years. And after the lunch rush, she stepped outside to take a little smoke break. She went out the back door and stood against the side of the building that was facing the parking lot as she usually did. But that day as she smoked, she saw a black Jeep pull into the parking lot. A woman got out of the passenger side and just kind of stood there. And Dana gave her a friendly smile as they made eye contact. But Karen didn't smile back. She had a blank look on her face and just kind of stared at Dana for a minute before Scott walked around to her side of the car. He closed the car door and took her by the arm to walk her into the front door. Dana wondered what was wrong with this woman, but she didn't think about it too long because she had to head back inside and go back to work. While they ate, Karen used the bathroom as Scott stood outside. And while she was in there by herself, she looked in her purse and took out the pad of paper and the pen that she had taken from the Days Inn. She wrote a note that said, quote, "My name is Karen Kummerer. I've been abducted. Please call the Daytona Beach Police Department. This is not a joke, and please be quiet." She left the note in the bathroom and came back out since Scott was waiting for her. She hoped that someone would find the note, but also worried that they would say something while she and Scott were still in there eating. She was terrified for what he would do if he found out what she had done. But soon enough, they left the barbecue place and eventually stopped at a gas station. And once again, she used the bathroom. She was terrified knowing that Scott was right outside the door, stopping anyone from getting to her. But she still managed to leave another note hanging from the tank of the toilet. 20 minutes later, back at the barbecue restaurant, Dana Preston needed to use the restroom herself. But as she turned around to flush, she noticed there was something sticking out of the tank. It wasn't supposed to be there, so she was just going to clean up whatever trash someone had left behind. But when she got a closer look and read what the note said, she immediately had chills over her entire body. She said she instantly knew exactly who had written that note. She ran out of the bathroom and straight to the phone to call the police. And they asked if Karen and Scott were still there, but Dana told them they had already left. When she thought back to when they pulled into the parking lot, she realized Karen wasn't being mean by not smiling back. She looked scared. The blank stare on her face was terror. Once Janet Hawkins caught wind of the note that had been found in North Carolina, she and her team were elated, because they knew that not only was Karen still alive, but she had enough presence of mind to leave them a note. They didn't know what Scott had been doing to Karen at all. She could have been drugged, they thought she might have been dead already, but this was a great sign. Brenna was also extremely relieved when she learned about the note. She still had hope that Karen was alive. They realized that Scott had crossed several state lines, which was way out of their jurisdiction, so that was when they needed to bring in the FBI. Karen's decision to leave behind notes was extremely smart and very useful, because it gave the police a trail to follow. Despite how scared she was of him hurting her, she realized she had to do something to save herself, otherwise they were never going to find her. And Scott was like a ticking time bomb. The hotels they were staying in didn't require an ID and only took cash, because he didn't want to show an ID at this point. And multiple times during this whole experience, Karen told Scott to just leave her there or leave her on the side of the road, but he always refused. By December 1st, it had been 5 days since Scott had first taken Karen. They left Pigeon Forge, North Carolina, and headed southwest to Trenton, Georgia, where Karen left another note at a gas station when they stopped. They continued heading southwest into Alabama and ended up in Sneed, where she left another note in a gas station. She would leave them on toilet paper rolls, towel racks, or under toilet seats. They stayed in a hotel across the street from another Wachovia bank, and at that point they were getting pretty low on cash. So Karen suggested they go over to the bank and take some cash out, which made Scott really upset. He took the knife and slammed it down and said, "Don't forget I always have this." At this point, she didn't know if police were getting the notes that she had been leaving, but they were. And each one was more confirmation that she was still alive. It was a little frustrating for police at this time because it seemed like they were always one step behind them. But they knew that time was of the essence. The more time that went by, the more worried they became they wouldn't find Karen alive. And while Karen was in hotel rooms with Scott, she made sure the TV never turned on in case her kidnapping and the notes that she was leaving came up on the news. She was afraid of what he would do at that point. And by December 4th, Karen had been captive for 8 days. That Monday, they drove from New Albany, Mississippi to Greenville, Mississippi, and their cash was really low. So they stopped at a gas station, and as they were getting ready to leave, Scott told Karen he needed to make a phone call. He got out of the car and walked a few steps away to the back, and Karen could hear Scott yelling, but she didn't know what he was saying or who he had been talking to. She just knew he was really angry, which was never good for her. As it turned out, Scott had called his mother to ask for more money, but thankfully, police had been monitoring Scott's parents' phone, and they were able to intercept this phone call from Scott to his mother. Scott was demanding money. Scott's mother told him all she had was about $150, and that made Scott extremely angry, and very mean back to his mother. They recorded Scott saying, quote, "Just go to the bank and put it fucking in. I can't believe you haven't done anything. And $150 ain't gonna do nothing. $150 is gonna make me fucking hurt somebody to get money." He told her, "You better get some more money or he's gonna have to do something to get that money." Threatening to his mother that he's gonna hurt someone to get money if she can't produce some for him. The way Scott was speaking to his mother was more than just angry. It was awful. But he was on the phone for long enough for the FBI to trace the call, so they knew that he was in Greenville, Mississippi. Scott and Karen then went to an ATM and took the $150 out, which law enforcement was monitoring, so they immediately sent the FBI and local law enforcement to the location of the ATM. After leaving the ATM, Karen and Scott stopped in a nearby neighborhood and bought some crack. And then they took off down the highway. Anne LaHaye, a former FBI special agent, had driven home for lunch, which she sometimes did, and she was sitting at her kitchen table eating a sandwich when her phone rang. It was her supervisor, who asked her to stop whatever she was doing and get on the road to head toward a small town called Leland, Mississippi. She was on the phone with the Mississippi Highway Patrol, Washington County Sheriff's Office, and Cleveland PD all at once, and within 5 minutes of being on Highway 61, she knew the description of the vehicle and exactly what both Scott Freeman and Karen looked like, and within 2 minutes, she spotted what she believed to be Scott's car. As she drove alongside the Jeep, it was obvious that it was Karen in the passenger seat. She was staring straight forward, and she could see the fear in her face as she stared. There was no talking, and Scott was also staring dead forward. At that point, she and her supervisor had contacted the Mississippi Highway Patrol, and there were thankfully several units in the area. And soon enough, police were trailing Scott on Highway 61. As the cops began pulling up behind him, Scott turned to Karen and said, "They're following us." And Karen asked him, "What are you talking about?" But sure enough, as she looked up, she saw what appeared to be 10 police cars following them with their lights on. Scott began screaming as he sped up the car, trying to outrun these 10 police cars. Karen also began screaming at Scott because she was terrified that he was going to crash and kill them both. And then Scott took a sharp turn off an exit from the highway. Karen knew he still had the knife, and she was terrified that at any moment he could just reach over and take her out. She was so close to being saved, and yet she was in the most danger that she had been in throughout the entire kidnapping. And then, all of a sudden, police cars were on each side of the car, with more stopped blocking their path ahead. So Scott had to come to a screeching halt. Immediately, around 25 police officers got out of their car with their guns drawn as they approached the Jeep. Even though there were police everywhere, Karen still thought she was going to die. But seconds later, an officer yanked open the door and pulled Scott out of the truck and threw him to the ground. At the same time, a deputy came to Karen's side of the car and grabbed her. She asked him, "Do you have a gun?" And he said yes. So she told him, "Don't let me go." He brought her over to the EMS, who took her blood pressure, which was now at 250 over 150. It was through the roof. Normal is 120 over 80. But Karen didn't want to go to the hospital because she didn't want to leave the deputy that had pulled her out of the car. It was the first time that she had felt safe in 8 days. This deputy calmed Karen down as best he could and brought her over to Anne LaHaye's truck. He put Karen into the car and told her that she was going to be safe here. The FBI called Brenna and told her, "We've got Karen and Scott's in custody," which was a surreal moment. It was such a relief to have Scott Freeman in custody. So much so that it was very emotional for the whole team that had been working on Karen's case. They had been so terrified for her the whole time, and they finally had her safe and alive. Law enforcement searched Scott's Jeep after he was in custody, and they found a switchblade knife in the open position in the driver's side door pocket. He had rope, blankets, and a can used to smoke crack cocaine, which showed that Scott and Scott alone had planned this. Once he was arrested, the Daytona police decided Karen had been through so much trauma, it would be better to not put her on an airplane home. But two officers would drive up and then take her home from Mississippi themselves. When they got there, Karen appeared to be worn out and tired. So they just made her as comfortable as they could as they drove her 13 hours back to Daytona Beach. They finally got back around 4 a.m., and Brenna said she gave Karen the biggest hug when she saw her again. They stayed awake as long as possible to spend as much time with her loved ones as they could. She was incredibly thankful to be rescued by authorities and set her focus on putting her life back together. She said she planned to spend more time with her family, see a therapist, and go back to work. The support she received from her family helped her slowly heal and regain stability. In 2008, she testified against Joseph Scott Freeman, speaking about how she was under excessive control while being held by him and accusing him of sexual assault. though no charges for that were ultimately filed. The incident is far behind her now, but the impact of the ordeal still remains a part of her past. Scott Freeman was charged with aggravated stalking, kidnapping with a weapon, violation of an injunction against domestic violence, and violation of probation. In 2007, he was found guilty of all charges and sentenced to life in prison. Scott Freeman served 18 years behind bars before he died while incarcerated in 2025. And for a long time, Karen was traumatized. Everything scared her. Any loud sound, people couldn't talk very loud around her, and she wanted someone with her at all times. The fear was paralyzing for a very long time. But for what she had been through, Brenna said she admires how strong Karen is as a person. And she's doing great today. She approaches life a lot differently. She feels so lucky to be alive, and she lives her life to the fullest. Most recently, she's been working part-time as a finance administrator at First Church, which it seems is a job that she really enjoys. She also has a son and a grandson who she loves, and she enjoys spending time at the beach, gardening, and playing with her dog Willie in her free time. However, she has always wanted to help others with her experience and hopes that it helps someone somewhere someday. If you are experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233 or go to thehotline.org. All calls are toll-free and confidential. The hotline is available 24/7 in more than 170 languages. But that is Karen Kummerer's story. I am so glad to hear that she's doing better and is living her life and has a grandson and likes to garden and hang out with her dog and just has a job that she likes and is enjoying her life. That is such a traumatic thing to go through. She was captive for 8 days with a man who she thought would kill her at any moment. That couldn't have been an easy thing to overcome, and yet she did. It's really shocking to see how quickly this relationship spiraled out of control. But I can kind of see how it happened. I mean, she had been in a marriage for 17 years, which seemed to not be good for a long time. We obviously don't have the specifics on that marriage or the details of why it ended, but from the little that we do know, it seems like she was unhappy for a while, and then Scott came into her life and she was really happy. He was probably love-bombing her as he had done with Kim and was with her all the time. He moved himself into her place, and because she didn't want to end the relationship, she just kind of let it happen. And then from there, it spiraled out of control. She didn't go into this relationship knowing what to expect or that he was going to do a complete 180 so quickly. It's also very common to hear people saying that they are embarrassed that they're in a relationship that spiraled out of control like that and became abusive. She didn't know how this could have happened to her, and there was most likely some shame going on, which was leading her to probably not share any of it with her family members or friends until it became way out of her control. And Scott Freeman was a particularly dangerous and, I'm assuming, mentally ill man. But regardless of the situation she found herself in, she did manage to get him out of her house with the help of her friends and family, which is amazing because in situations like that, it's really difficult to get a hold on it yourself. So the people around her really helped her and got her out of it, but Scott was already so dangerous that it didn't really matter. He had set his sights on her. But she still managed to save herself by leaving notes along the way. So my point is, she did a good job. Even though she wasn't able to spot the red flags well in the beginning, she still managed to save her own life. And that is something that's worth celebrating. Also, shout out to Brenna, who was only 19 at the time, but really stepped in to help Karen, her aunt, and wanted to protect her, and knew how dangerous the situation was, and had the awareness to know that something was wrong, and she called the police and got this whole thing started. Because they would have known eventually that Karen was missing, but Brenna managed to figure out that Karen had been abducted only minutes after she was abducted. So that's amazing as well. I'm also glad that Scott's gone. I'm sure that gives Karen some peace of mind. But I think that's all I have to say about that, so why don't we move on to a bit of a palate cleanser and I can tell you something good, that way we can move on with our days as normal. My good thing is that at the time this episode comes out on Tuesday, my birthday's tomorrow, on Wednesday. How fun is that? I don't actually know what I'm gonna do on my birthday. Maybe I will go out to dinner with Alex, or maybe not. I really don't know. But I've decided that what I do want to do for my birthday at some point is go on a ghost tour. So I'm going to be going on a ghost tour with my friends in like the middle of September because that's when they're available. Because making plans as an adult is a nightmare. You text your friends and you're like, hey, are you available this day? And they say no. And then you're like, okay, how about a month from now? And then they're like, no. And they're like, okay, push it one more week forward. Are you free then? And that is when we're able to go on a ghost tour for my birthday. So it'll be about a month from now, but I'm sure I will bring it back up in a month. So check back in if you're curious. But anyway, thank you all so much for listening. If you would like to get access to all of our bonus episodes, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. This summer has been insanely crazy, but I'm going to get back into the swing of posting on the YouTube channel where you can find stories just like this over at Steph Today. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival or something crazy that's happened to you and you would like to share it with us and possibly hear it on another listener's episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. I post pictures of all the stories we talk about over on Instagram at nottoday_podcast. We have a TikTok that is nottodaypodcast and a Twitter that is nottodaypodcast, but the T on the podcast is a 3 because that makes sense. And just keep breathing. Yeah.